Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good morning and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and today we are going to be talking about a topic that has been all over the media, which is early specialization for youth sports and how that applies to tennis and our junior players. And I'm really, really looking forward to digging into this topic with our guest today, Dr. Neeru Jayanthi. And Dr. Jay is new to the Atlanta area. He has just moved here from Chicago and is working with Emory University and their hospital system to set up a tennis-specific practice at Emory, and I'm going to let him talk more about the work he's doing there and the affiliations that he's got locally and nationally and all of that, but it's pretty exciting for us to have that resource locally in Atlanta and also for us at Parenting Aces to have the contact so that we can continue to provide you, the parents of junior players, and I can't even say we anymore because mine's not a junior anymore, but I want to be able to continue to provide you guys with really helpful information. And we've been at kind of a loss when we've been searching for tennis-specific health information, injury prevention, treatment options, and all of those things. So I'm pretty excited to have Dr. J with us and get to pick his brain a bit. Before I bring him on the line, I want to go to a quick PSA, but when we come back, Dr. Neeru Jayanthi.
Warning. Orthopedic surgeons are seeing an increase in overuse injuries when young athletes perform the same repetitive stressful motions over and over. Pitching, tennis, weight training, even long swimming workouts can cause overuse trauma that may require surgery. If your kids play and train hard, visit orthoinfo.org or stopsportsinjuries.org. A message from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine.
Welcome back to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and we're going to jump in 1 second. Before I bring Dr. J on the line, I just want to remind you guys of our call-in number in case you've got questions today. That number is 714-583-6853. Again, 714-583-6853 if you'd like to call in and chat with us. Also, because next week is a holiday and because my college kid is coming home and my grown-up kid who lives in California is coming home for Thanksgiving, I am going to be taking a break from the radio show. So there will be no show next week, but we will resume as scheduled in the following week. So I hope you'll forgive me for that, and I hope you'll take the opportunity to either catch up on some of our past shows or just simply enjoy time with your family, whether you're spending your Thanksgiving at a junior tournament or hanging out at home. All right, without further ado, let me bring Dr. Neeru Jayanthi on the line. Neeru, thanks so much for being with us today. How are you?
Great, Lisa. Thanks for having me out here and looking forward to getting in the Atlanta tennis community out here.
Well, I think you have jumped in with both feet and are off to a great start making contacts and connections here. Before we jump into today's topic about early specialization, I want to just give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about your tennis background, because I think it's important for my listeners to know that not only are you a physician, but you also have extensive experience as a tennis player.
Yeah, you know, it's who had ever thought I would actually merge my two greatest passions together, right? Tennis and medicine. But I grew up actually in the Chicagoland area and played junior tennis and competed and actually was at crossroads in college. I was walking into a Big Ten school, University of Illinois, and trying to decide about that and a medical career and all the components to it. And so I end up, which I think ended up being the right choice, pursuing the medical career. I taught for many years and continue to play competitively. And, you know, so happy I found my 5-0 team here in Atlanta. It's very, very competitive out here. So we really had to make sure that, you know, you get hooked up with your team. And through training, I ended up getting hooked up with the ATP tournament that was held in Indianapolis. And at that time, I didn't even see this whole medical issues related to tennis as any sort of career path. And I started attending conferences through the Society of Tennis Medicine and Science, which is an organization of all the therapists and doctors throughout the world who take care of tennis players. And I got very intrigued. So over the last 15 years, I've been actively involved and continuing to play competitively and actually get on court with kids when they were hurt, and kind of found this niche within the Chicagoland area. After about 15 years of this, I ended up, before I knew it, I was became president of this organization just this last May in Rome. And now over the next 4 years, my goal to try to help take the content that we have that we use at the tour level and internationally and bring it locally and try to help integrate that into a community such as the Atlantic community, but really the Southeast region, and help continue to educate and train as many medical people and tennis people on the appropriate way to use the evidence to help treat tennis players. And so it's a big challenge. Atlanta's a huge tennis town and huge market. And I'm new to the area, but hopefully we can, you know, get some good traction with just doing the right type of thing. So looking forward to it.
And I want to just mention to my listeners, too, that you and I are planning to have you be a regular guest on this show and provide ongoing content around tennis medicine and how it applies to our junior players and college players as well. So I'm real excited about working with you and being able to provide cutting-edge information to our listeners, because any of us who have had our child suffer through an injury, whether it's tennis-induced or not, understands the frustration level when we take our child to an orthopedist or to another medical doctor for evaluation, and if that practitioner doesn't have a good grip on what it takes to train successfully as a junior tennis player, oftentimes the advice that they give us isn't really applicable to our kids, or isn't necessarily the advice that's best serving our children as they continue to train. So it's just, I mean, it's amazing to have you as this resource now, and I'm so pleased that we connected and that we'll be working together.
Yeah, no, I am, you know, the key part is really reaching the parents and the coaches, and that's why I jumped at the opportunity to meet you. And one of our newer members, Nicole Pitts, was on the show, I think, you know, a few months back, and I emailed her, like, probably within seconds of finding out and saying I had to meet you and help send this message through parents and coaches. And, you know, when we set up this program at Emory, it was, I mean, initially they were like, okay, great, we'll just be the place where when your elbow hurts, you come see us. And I said, no, tennis, treating tennis players and taking care of them is much more comprehensive. And we put about 6 pages in our site. If you just Google Emory and tennis medicine, it is about recognizing which types of injuries and which type of players would be more at risk, when you need to be seen, what type of prevention things you can do, which stroke mechanics may cause you more risk for injury. And a lot, it's just all of it's educational. So it's not necessarily meant just for people to come and see us when you get hurt, but you could be anywhere in the country, and hopefully you can access it and get some content that at least helps drive some of your decision-making about what to do, because as you said, it's really hard to find people who understand, you know, a competitive junior tennis player and what their needs are, and I hope we can give some of that. And like you said, we'll continue to keep providing education throughout, you know, the year, and, you know, keep looking for new ideas from the people who are listening to your show.
Great. And, you know, one of the things that I think is so cool about your approach is you're not only evaluating them in your office in an exam room, but you also get out on the tennis court with these kids, watch them hit balls, watch their stroke mechanics, watch their movement, and are able to evaluate what types of things are healthy and which may not be healthy, and then work with their coach and help make the necessary changes in their game to keep them injury-free as much as possible. So I just, you know, for the parents listening, this is just an incredible thing that's happening here in Atlanta. And for NIRU to make this information available to us through the website and through podcasts like this, it's just incredible. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thanks for, you know, that, you know, positive feedback. But, you know, it really grew out of frustration. I was actually frustrated of just being a regular doctor and telling them, well, you know, this could happen, you know, if you do this on court. And so maybe you should try to, you know, be careful about that and maybe, you know, work on it. But it, as you know, in tennis, it's very visual and it's action oriented. And you know, I wasn't there. I worked very closely with our teaching pros. I never took a kid out of their environment of who they work with. It was to help the coach. A lot of them came back from serious stress injuries, and they were actually looking for some help as well, too. Said, look, you know, I can't have this kid keep coming back and getting hurt. What do you think you could do? So it's very collaborative. And I would usually do a one-time eval, and, you know, I started doing that a little bit here as well, too. And occasionally I'd, you know, see him a second time or something like that. And just provide feedback. And what I call is you're trying to accommodate for an injury. And so not everyone gets away with it. You know, they may hit great strokes, but if they continue to come back with low back, you know, stress injuries, then something has to be altered specific to the diagnosis to help them out. And so we're going to probably move forward and try to do a research study evaluating at a number, like probably a few hundred juniors in the area, and try to look at their strokes and then follow them and see if actually having good stroke mechanics prevents you from having injuries. So it'll be one of our next projects. Mark Kovacs, who's been in the area, who I know you know well, is just phenomenal performance specialist as well, too, and work with USTA. And he and I hopefully can, you know, combine some of our efforts on some of these things to get the kids healthy.
Awesome. Well, so for today, we're going to focus around sports specialization. This is a hot topic. I post articles all the time about what's the appropriate age for kids to specialize and, you know, at what point in terms of tennis are they behind the curve if they don't specialize at, you know, by a certain age and all of this. And so you've really studied this whole issue and have some great information to share. So I'm going to let you jump right in.
Sure. You know, it's one of those things you kind of stumble into things sometimes. And, you know, I had done probably about three or four different research studies looking at junior tennis and match volume. And we published one article on, you know, looking at the medical withdrawal rates at national tournaments. And, you know, if you got beyond, you know, five or more matches, it seemed like more kids were pulling out of tournaments. And so several different kind of tournament-based studies. And then we actually did one where we looked at about 520 Midwest junior tennis players who were playing at the closed, Midwest closed, which is pretty competitive where we were at that time. And this is about 7 years ago, I think. And then we followed them for the summer. We wanted to look at the characteristics of the kids who would either pull out of tournaments or report an injury. So one of the most prominent ones, well, the ones that were striking to us, first of all, if you had a prior injury, you're always more at risk. And I think our data showed that for that group, it was about five times a higher risk. So we try to identify those high-risk kids. So that was one for sure. But we happened to notice a trend, and I was interested in this whole concept of when kids were just playing one sport. So the average age that kids decided to only play tennis was 10. And this is, again, in the Midwest, you know, sectional level. So a lot of very good players. But we also noticed that their risk of injury increased by about 150% for those kids who decided to, specialize only in tennis. And so, you know, it just happened to be we produced that information, we presented it, and then we presented it at one of our world congresses. I think it was in Valencia, Spain at that time. And it was at the time Andre Agassi wrote his book, The Open. And I think most of us have read at least portions of it, and mm-hmm. he popularized this concept of being pushed very hard to do tennis only very, very young. And so it grew a lot of questions of whether that was a good idea or not. And, of course, now it's hard to argue an 8-time Grand Slam champion, even though he ended up getting burnt out and did a few drugs in the way, but he had some good results, right? But is that the best approach for all kids? So this extended beyond. I end up getting all these different media opportunities and questions, and extended beyond tennis even. They said, well, does this apply to all other sports? And I said, no, we have to really fully evaluate them through research and following lots of kids before we extend our recommendations. And even then, it wasn't, that was just a one-time study. So over about a five-year period, we followed about 1,200 Chicagoland athletes and of all sports, but quite a few of them were tennis players. And we looked at their risks of injury and overuse injury and serious overuse injury. We found a striking correlation between playing a single sport versus being diversified, and those kids who are doing more multiple sports and actually not competing year-round. So that risk is pretty well established. And in our medical world, it was the first time we've established and published anything, I mean, not just us, but throughout the world, that was published on a group of athletes identifying that risk. And as a result of it, we just ended up getting a ton of traction through media, because now the debate is it a bad idea? And I think that's, we were just at USPTA World Congress, presenting a panel on that as the opening segment. And there's a lot of healthy debate. And I don't want to seem too one-sided because I'm giving you data from the injury side, but we're really evaluating if and when it is appropriate to do a single sport. So maybe I throw that back at you. How did your children approach that? And age did they do tennis? And
yeah, well, only my son played tennis. My daughters played other sports, but never really got to the level that my son got to in tennis. And he, at a young age, played soccer, played baseball, and really those were the only two organized sports he did outside of tennis. But at age 9, he really chose to jump into tennis full time and to the exclusion of the other sports. And so, he is definitely an example of early specialization. He, knock on wood, he did not suffer with injuries as a young child or even as a young teen. But once he got, I would say probably age 16, is when some of the, more overuse type injuries started to rear their ugly head. And, luckily for him, it's nothing that kept him out on a long-term basis. And, but it's the kind of thing that you need to take a few weeks off and get treated and rest up. And then that whole question comes in of, when do I go back? How do I go back? What do I do while I'm not on the court to make sure my fitness level doesn't deteriorate, to make sure my timing doesn't disappear, to make sure my footwork skills don't disappear? And so those are all, to me, the concerns that these kids face, and where it's such a huge advantage to have a physician or, more than just the physician, but a whole medical community that understands the sport and how kids train for it.
So your son is the classic example. That's the norm. That's not the exception by any stretch. So, that is the path to, junior elite tennis. And then the question is, this is multifaceted, but the question is that the only path, or are there a variety of paths? And if you choose that path, I think we can probably safely say that it is more risky. I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. But it's more risky as far as your injury risk. But there's a calculated risk you have in playing sports, and sort of what risk should you try to assume. And so if you do, he was fortunate, while many of our young athletes, I think a lot of our data actually was biased because it was driven by a lot of junior competitive tennis players in this whole single sport model when we looked at 1,200 athletes, and a lot of the injuries were actually from serious overuse injuries in young tennis players. And so, but it's a calculated risk, right? So then the question could be, if you choose the risky path of early specialization, is it possible to still have elite success? I'm sure it is, actually. Is it the message we should send for everybody to do? Probably not, because not everyone will be successful, but not everyone will also be lucky enough to not have problems. So I think if you do choose that path, my suggestion is you just have to have increased monitoring. And I think that's Mark Kovacs and I have done a few kind of panels and debates about this at different national conferences, and I think we end up agreeing on this concept that there are a group of people that will start early and need to do it and will be doing tons of hours a week and actually end up being successful. They will be at increased risk for injury, and we just need to monitor them better and then do injury prevention programs and off-court training and all these things. We just can't make that the rule for everybody, I don't believe. I think that the diversification is a big issue in terms of inclusivity for sport. Like, junior elite tennis is great, but we're still only talking about a minority of junior tennis players or tennis players really in our country. And if we want the sport to be successful, I think you have to have a participation-based goal of getting kids interested in wanting to stay involved in the sport and being allowed to play soccer and other sports and not necessarily being told that if you don't, by 9 or 10 years old, only do tennis and not make time only for tennis, then it pushes other kids away. And not every kid is going to have a national ranking and play in college. But we need lots of junior players, a lot of kids to be playing tennis so that we have adults playing tennis and our sport is healthy.
Agreed. It's interesting. I just watched the new documentary on Cristiano Ronaldo. I don't know if you've seen it yet. And he's the soccer player from Portugal. And it's one of the things that he says, he wound up getting injured before, I believe it was World Cup that was the tournament where he got injured. But he said something that I thought was so interesting, and I've heard this from tennis players at the professional level as well, which is if you're going to play at the elite level, you have to get used to playing in pain because pretty much you're in pain every day. And it's such a sad statement to hear, and it makes me wonder, is that truly the case? Does an athlete competing at the highest level of their sport, is it just a given that more often than not, something is going to be hurting in their body?
I do some consulting work with WTA and help cover ATP tournaments for about 15 years. And I would say the management of your body through all of that is very common. And then at the college level, I really, to be honest, felt very sorry for many college athletes who all know, if you've ever been a parent of one or coached one, it is challenging. I've treated hundreds and hundreds of college athletes, and, it is a challenge to be a college athlete. And, yes, the expectation is actually that, you're not going to be 100% healthy every time. And I actually tell kids that as much of an advocate for for the safety of young athletes. When you get to college, that's the time that you're putting it all out there, and that's you're on scholarship, whatever it is. So I think there's quite a bit of truth to that, unfortunately, and I think their job, aside from education, of course, is to help take care of their body, and it's not always going to be 100%. So then the philosophical debate comes, when is that appropriate for a kid? So let's take tennis out of there. I have many gymnasts who we had an article in the Wall Street Journal that came out, and we featured one of our these kids I was treating, and when the girl was a high level 8 or level 9 gymnast, and she had basically a stress fracture in her wrist growth plate when she was 12. And at 13, she came in to see me the day before the Wall Street Journal was going to do a photo shoot, and she came in again, and she had a wrist stress fracture on the other side, and we had to put her in a cast, even though she had a shoot for the Wall Street Journal about preventing injury from a family who totally understood it. And her quote in there was, I think just injuries are just, you're just supposed to have it when you do gymnastics and you do competitive sports. So, and that's a very reasonable family with a very reasonable mom. And I thought, philosophically, is that okay? Is it okay to say that you can have multiple stress injuries, stress fractures, surgeries, and these types of things in young athletes? Well, we have accepted it in college and professional, but is it okay to do that? And that's a question for the parents. And I think my feeling is that we have to start having some advocacy for the younger kids when these things, when these patterns are happening. And, you know, I'm pretty realistic. Like, I want junior development. I want pathways that create some of the top players, and I recognize those pathways. And we sit, actually, we you know, with the WTA, we spend a lot of time looking exactly at the pathway, what it takes to be an elite-level player, but you also look at all the player development programs and resources that are just enormous amount of resources that are invested in keeping them healthy physically and psychologically. And to be honest, junior players don't have those resources, and that's the difference. Right. And so, you know, in college you have more resources. In the professional level, you have tons of resources, and the junior player doesn't have those resources, and you're still asking them to go through this process in the same way. I think that's what we have to be cautious of.
And I think, you know, the question is it possible to reach that high level without early specialization? And is it possible to reach that high level and 100% avoid injury? And, you know, I suspect the answer is no on both counts. And so then, you know, again, like you said, it comes back to that whole philosophical issue of, is this what we want for our children? And the answer is going to be different for every family, right?
Well, first of all, I would disagree, you know, without sharing any specific data from the tour yet, everything is preliminary, but I can tell you in general, on review of most data on almost all sports across the board, we published an article reviewing the age of specialization and intense training, and almost everyone was above the age of 12 to develop elite level athletics, and only gymnastics was actually below that number. We don't have good data on tennis, and that's one of my goals, is actually produce that for tennis as far as the age, which is successful. But no, it's not required to specialize early in order to be successful. I actually challenge the notion that it is necessary to produce data that in fact is helpful. I think either there's two paths, and one path is early specialization. Well, there's many paths, but one is early specialization and intense training starting early. I think it's riskier, more likely to have injury, burnout, attrition. But some people are successful, some people are not. And some people will be phenomenal players, and some people will quit by 12 and hate their parents and, you know, never want to touch a racket again, particularly after high school or college. But there's another path, which is enjoying your pathway and having higher satisfaction ratings, and less overall risk for injury, not zero, but less overall risk for injury. And then and that path is diversification to some extent, to maybe middle adolescence. So that could be potentially 12 years old for, you know, a female, maybe 13 or 14 for a male, and still progress and be successful. Would you be less successful doing that path? The scientific answer is we don't know. The tennis answer is yes, you would be less successful because our tennis design is set up to be early, you know, early specialized, and that's really the only model that we have in year-round training and everything. I mean, it's really actually, because everyone does it the same way already, it's very hard to see what it's like if you don't do it. Because that's a problem with trying to evaluate from a science point of view, a research point of view.
Right. So, I mean, let's talk specifics then. You know, it's, we say early specialization. What does that mean? Is it what you were saying, mid-adolescence, and the ages are different for males and females, or
right.
And does it differ by sport?
Right. So great questions, and this is the million-dollar question. So, you know, I was invited to be a part of U.S. Open, I think it was a media release, about multi-sport play as part of the Aspen Institute, which is they have a sport and society program, which is trying to change the culture of youth sports, not just tennis, but of trying to make it, again, more participatory, inclusive to every type of child, even those with disabilities and medical issues, and really addressing it while still maintaining the focus of developing high-level athletes. But there were about 28 national governing bodies who signed on to this marketing campaign that was published in multiple journals, and I think there's going to be follow-up from it there, and it was released at the U.S. Open, supported and endorsed by USTA, which you can have your positive or negative feelings about that, but supported and endorsed as an ideal concept to try multi-sport play until at least the age of 12. Why that number is somewhat arbitrary, we totally understand. That applied to all sports, but that's about middle adolescence. We have some data that suggests your injury risk goes higher if you do it younger than that. So I think there's some basis around that age, and we may not pin down the exact number, and obviously males and females are different, but we know that 8 is too young. We know that we can agree that under 10 is probably too young. So I think pinning down the exact age, it is sport dependent, and it really, you know, it's a philosophical question too for a family. And you know, early introduction is fine. I have a 2.5-year-old. He's been on the tennis court 60 times. He's been to 5 ATP tournaments, and he has a 10-foot net at home, and he can honestly hit a forehand. I've never even taught him. He just watches, and he hits a forehand better than 5- and 7-year-olds, like just by drop feet on his own. And it's only because of his exposure. But he also has a basketball. He's in swim class. We had him in soccer, like just doing different things, free play. So I think early introduction is okay. But the diversification and allowing exploration and doing lots of things is really critical, I think, to your growth.
There's this whole statement that's been passed around lately, which is develop the athlete, not the tennis player, or develop the athlete first and then the tennis player, I guess is a better way to say it. Meaning, you know, expose the child to all different kinds of physical activities, not just organized sports, but like you just mentioned, free play, you know, swimming, all sorts of activities, so that they develop their athletic skills around a wide range of uses. And then once they do come to specialize in tennis, they are better prepared to handle the challenges on a physical level that tennis presents. What are your thoughts on that?
So when we had the panel at USPTA World Congress in September, we had an interesting group of folks, and Paul Lubbers from USTA Player Development comes from mm-hmm. what does it take to get the best junior player developed really into the next, you know, top professional player. And so he likes that for the reasons you stated, to develop a great athlete and then try to get athletes into tennis, and then you can make an athlete into a better tennis player. It's a lot easier to do that than it is to take someone who's not as great of an athlete and just keep training him over and over again, which is sort of our model currently. Then Kurt Camperman, who's the kind of director and CEO from the community side of USTA, is really interested in getting a lot of kids to participate in tennis. I probably fall somewhere in the middle. I'd like both, and I think a lot of us probably fall somewhere in the middle. But so that philosophy is also good because it's appealing to any family to say, oh, great, so we can still do our soccer or other sports, whatever it is, and not feel like we're, you know, being pulled away. And yes, it probably does have this extrinsic benefit of getting athletic skills by a variety of things. I actually did an on-court evaluation with a kid, and I actually recommended that he go play soccer. And he was 13. I said, you know, I think the best thing for him is to get this, because coaches have asked him to try to keep working his lower body, but, you know, to work on your lower body is not, it's just not easily said. So you just, you know, get down. But if you don't have the physical capabilities to actually lower and do a lunge position and do lateral movement patterns and be able to tolerate the things that you need to and then hit a tennis ball, it's complicated. So, you know, do another activity that allows you to do it so you don't have to think about the ball at the same time. And then when you develop those athletic skills, tennis becomes a much easier sport. So yes, I definitely agree, but it's a perspective, which perspective you're coming at it from.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. From the parental side, I can tell you that we parents get pressure from coaches to take our kids out of all other activities because, A, what if they get hurt playing that other sport? B, what if they have a practice or game that conflicts with a tournament or tournament preparation? There are all sorts of reasons that coaches give. So where does the coaching education come into the work you're doing to make sure that the coaches are sending the right message to the parents?
So, you know, that's a tough one. I think there's a lot of excellent, excellent coaches. And I hate to categorize as ones that aren't. I think there's coaches that may not have as much of an interest in continuing to educate and evolve as sports evolves and our data evolves. And it's probably nobody who's listening. I think everyone who's listening is interested in education. When we go to the USPTA World Congress, it's probably not even those folks. And when we speak at PTR, all the people who are interested in education and evolving generally are on board with that concept. Now, there's a business aspect and all these other aspects to it, which I totally am sensitive to. So we have to come up with solutions that actually make sense from a business point of view. So if you have a junior development tennis academy and half your kids are leaving because they're playing other sports, you have to figure out a way of doing something that keeps them in the academy. So a thought could be to create environments to allow multi-sport play within your own academy, even for your the youngest kids. And so maybe you pull away the 10-foot net a couple days a week for the youngest kids, and now you're using soccer goals and basketballs and have them do other activities, but can keep them in your environment, and maybe that makes more business sense. I actually think that a lot of this makes intuitive sense for most coaches. They're pretty smart. They understand athleticism, and I think that's what they would like. It just also, there's a lot of logistics. So the other corollary, of course, is trying to develop rankings based on points. So while maybe some of us would agree that there are just too many requirements as far as volume of tournaments to be able to be highly successful, and so missing those would affect your ranking and then in turn would, make it harder for you to get in a larger tournament. Well, so we have to work to create environments that say, hey, look, maybe there's an elite pathway of these kids are going to play 15 to 24 tournaments a year and they're going to try to get elite level rankings and that's just the pathway for them. But maybe we have a pathway for junior players that is just level dependent, and it's not based on total volume and just trying to match them up with kids their age, and UTR, I was really big on that, but I think that concept mm-hmm. can work for a lot of, it works at the college level, I use it at the college level, but concept can work really to help make it appealing and do participatory-based events, play dates, team tennis. I think that's a big one that I'd really love to see grow for juniors so we can, get kids to really enjoy that camaraderie. Because junior tennis and professional tennis are the only two areas in tennis that are isolating an individual. And every other tennis is high school teams, it's college teams. It's all team-based except for the earliest and the latest ends of it. And so I don't think world team tennis is ever going to beat Wimbledon, but I think junior tennis can be attractive when it's also team-based and encourages positive behaviors.
Interesting. Yeah, I agree with you, to some degree. But, just speaking for my own kid, what attracted him to tennis was the individual nature of it. He thrives on being out there for himself and, of course, is excited to be in a team environment now that he's in college and is loving that. But what kept him interested all through his junior career was that the individual aspect of it. So,
good point,
you always have that push and pull too, and understanding the psychology of an individual sport versus a team sport is a piece of the puzzle as well. So, we're all searching for these simple answers to these huge questions, and the simple answer is there's no simple answer.
Yeah, you brought up a great point, actually. And so I don't want to extend beyond, you're asking questions in my opinion, but I have to be cautious of extending recommendations. These aren't recommendations. Those are some of my opinions. And I can give you reasonably good recommendations on the evidence regarding potential for injury risk, probably some based on development of, you know, successful athletes. But still, this whole modeling is far beyond me. I mean, there's many, many people who are working full-time trying to find solutions to do some of these things. So let me be respectful of those people who are doing a lot of really great work to try to help promote the sport and do a lot of these things and figuring out the right pathways. It's my opinion that team-based play can be attractive to introduce many more kids. And your son is also going down what we would have considered the traditional elite level pathway, which is fine. And I always will say it. I say it's not that we have to change the elite level pathway a lot. I believe that we probably have to have increased monitoring, increased education, when to look out for worrisome signs, have resources that include comprehensive education on nutrition and performance training, injury prevention, and those are necessary when you're doing the rigors of junior elite level pathway tennis. But I still think we have a big golden opportunity to have so many more kids participating in the sport and still enjoying it, doing team-based play and maybe only playing a match once a week, but loving it and looking forward to it and never getting burnt out and never playing in college competitively, but maybe they play club tennis and maybe they play as an adult and maybe they join an Alta League and USTA team when they're an adult. And I think that's right. Going to keep our sport healthy. And that's, I think that's the crux of it for me in the end, is you have to have some people. Because at the end, what is the terminal end of that pathway for the junior elite player? Is we don't have data on it, but I would guess a good amount of them don't pick up a racket anymore after the age of 22. And that's unfortunate.
That's a sad statement. Yeah, that's terrible. Well, you know, one of the big challenges that I see on a regular basis with tennis is it seems to me that we tend to combine elite development with growing the game. And there tends to be this confusion when a statement is sent out by USTA Player Development, for example, which, let's be clear, USTA Player Development is concerned with developing players to be top professional players. That's their goal, right? It's not to grow the sport. It's to find the next Serena and the next Isner and, you know, that level of player. There is the community tennis side, like you mentioned, that is concerned with growing the game generically, just basically getting more people to pick up rackets. And those two areas of USTA really don't have that much overlap. I mean, and they shouldn't, because the goals are very different. And the type of player that each of those two areas is attracting is very different. Do you agree with that?
You know, I've actually come to agree with exactly what you've said. And, you know, it takes a while to kind of explore and really listen to many, many coaches and parents and speak. I mean, literally all across the world and try to absorb things over time and really kind of figure out what's the quote-unquote right path. But, you know, that is a very individual thing. And I think, if we had to, we have two separate missions, I think, is a fair statement to say. Mark and I, like I said, tend to go back and forth about this, and I think we do agree that there's, no matter how you slice it, no matter what recommendation you make, there will always be a spin-off. So there, you can say you only do 10 hours a week if you're a 10-year-old, then there are going to be a group of people who are going to do 12 or 14 hours a week, and that's actually, it's going to be the way it is. We have to have some sort of guidelines to help guide the masses, per se, and try to, it's sort of like a speed limit. You have to have some idea of about where you should be. And then that other group of people, I think, just needs to be monitored, treated differently, have different resources, and, if families and parents choose that pathway, that's fine. That's acceptable for me. My only thing is, it's not all the parents. We have to be honest. Like, if you're a coach and you're looking at a kid, you have to be honest and say, is this kid really going to be can you train a kid out of their genetic predisposition to be a top-level elite player by exceeding all recommendations of training volume and specialization, all these types of things? And that kid is a vulnerable kid who may actually just get hurt a lot. He or she can't make it through and never will pick up a racket again, and then probably go off into a different sport or not exercise at all. So I think that's where we have to be cautious and honest and say, look, maybe your pathway is just a more diversified, I hate to use the word recreational because you can still be competitive, but more of a less competitive, less intense environment that allows for opportunities for other sports. So yeah, so I think we have to promote it. We have to sell that product better. And you're right. I mean, how can we kid ourselves and say that, you know, junior elite tennis is a way to grow the game? It's not. It's a way to develop
right.
top players. It's a separate. And I actually, you know, I spent a lot of time with folks at USC, and I have to come to the defense of them because I work at I've worked at large medical organizations, and USC is an enormous organization, right, with lots and lots of players and very individual decision making. And I would say that's they also would agree with you. I mean, I think, you know, the folks in player development have a very specific role. The folks in community have a very specific role. The folks in adult tennis and league tennis have a very specific role. So I don't think there are going to be a lot of people who disagree with that comment. I think we have to be fair when we say, when USTA says this, but you can't always have, like, this corollary to every statement they have and say, well, but that doesn't apply to me. But you have to, you know, understand that even within USTA, people will have a different opinion about how that affects their service line, per se.
Right. And I mean, I guess that's my point, is we see, you know, the letters USTA come after a statement, and we, the consumer, make the assumption that that's applying to all levels of the sport, when in reality, you can't just look at the USTA. You've got to look at what comes after that: player development, community tennis, adult league tennis, junior league, you know, whatever department the statement's coming out of. And so it gets back to we as consumers having a better understanding of what our national governing body can do and where people like you fit into the puzzle in terms of keeping our children healthy. And I think for the parents listening, and the coaches too, because let's face it, an injured kid isn't paying for private lessons. You know,
mm-hmm.
they're out.
Mm-hmm.
An injured kid isn't paying tournament injury fees. So it's in everybody's interest to keep these kids healthy and injury-free and take the steps necessary to, you know, ensure that as best we can, whether that means limiting the number of hours they train, limiting the number of tournaments they play, making sure that they diversify their physical activity before the age of 12, 13, 14, whatever that age turns out to be, and then making sure that when they do show signs of an impending injury, that we recognize those signs and have resources available to deal with it. And that's what you're trying to accomplish, I suspect.
Yeah, you summarized it really well. Like a kid who's not playing because of injury is a kid who's not paying. You know, so there's definitely
right.
There's a that's a bad business model.
They're paying the medical community.
Actually, it would be easier if I didn't do any of this and actually didn't try to prevent any injuries, because it's bad for my business to prevent these things. So I should actually just say the opposite. But let me share a few numbers. Like we have quite a bit of data on not just tennis, but I want to, you know, show you some numbers of tennis compared to other sports. And, you know, you can take from it what you want, but basically, you know, keep in mind the two pathways and trying to make it inviting, but also trying to develop, you know, top players. And we look at tennis, and this is in our data set, and it's biased by the fact that a lot of, you know, higher-level tennis players were seeing me, but tennis had the highest rate of specialization among all sports, including gymnastics, in our population of 1,200 athletes, and it was nearly 50% were highly specialized, and probably about 75 or 80% had some degree of specialization. They had the second highest organized weekly training amounts behind gymnastics. They had the lowest amount of free play, means doing activities for fun outside of tennis, you know, by far, actually. And so we created this sports training ratio, which is just basically how many organized hours you do compared to your free play hours. And if it exceeds 2 to 1, you're much more likely to have all-cause injuries, including serious injuries. And so tennis was, you know, we try to keep it below 2. Tennis was a 3.0, which is by far the highest. But in most players, it was actually a 4, 5, or a 6. In fact, I've had many that were infinity. In other words, they would do 22 hours a week of tennis and zero of anything else. And so, and then of course, had, you know, tennis had the highest rate of overuse injuries, had the highest, you know, rate of, you know, I'm sorry, the second highest rate of serious overuse injuries. So, and again, I'm not saying everyone who does tournament tennis is, you know, doomed and they're having, you know, everyone's going to get hurt. But clearly, tennis is makes it less like that pathway makes it less inviting if you're a parent trying to select out what to do. As far as junior elite tennis tournaments. So you just have to have another option. And if you choose the option that puts more at risk, you need to be monitored and have early recognition. And that's all, you know, I say, we're not going to tell everyone, don't, you know, play this much for everyone. I mean, there's going to be some kids who are going to exceed the hours per week rule of, you know, do less hours per week than your age. But, you know, if we say do less hours per week than your age of 10, is 20 appropriate? Probably not. You know, is 12 appropriate? Well, you know, if you're not getting hurt and you have good monitoring, then, you know, then it's working for you. So that last part is the critical part. Don't be afraid to, when you recognize something early, is say, hey, look, maybe something's going on. And I know there's not, like, tennis medicine doctors in every community throughout the country, but hopefully you find a trusting relationship with some healthcare provider who can at least tell you this is worrisome, this one's not, and move on. Because missing 3 months is bad for business for everybody.
Sure, for everybody. Well, so we're down to our last few minutes here. So I want to make sure that we leave the listeners with some solid takeaway messages and potential action steps that they can implement with their own junior players. So putting on your doctor hat right now, and then I'm going to ask you to put on your parent hat in a second, but putting on your doctor hat, what are the takeaway messages that you would like to leave listeners with?
So I actually think the first one is, if you have a strong junior tennis academy or training program, is develop a solid relationship with folks who have specific training in treating tennis players whose primary goal is to this. So it's the credentialing of choosing the right person. We believe that the Society for Tennis Medicine Science is a great way to get that type of education and maybe ask that they are involved in the organization, become members, and if they're doing performance stuff, you know, there's an International Tennis Performance Association, and they're doing evidence-based work and taking care of your players. So just making sure you have a relationship with the right type of provider. Then I think in the junior player, there's three high-risk areas: the low back, inside the elbow, and the shoulder. There's others, but those are the main ones. And so if you have symptoms, my general rule is if you have a day of pain in any of those areas, you just take a day off. If you have a week of pain, you take a week off. And if it's lasting anything longer than that, then you should probably get that evaluated, because most junior competitive high-level players are the ones that are high risk. For example, you have a 40% chance of having a stress injury, a stress fracture in the low back. We try to have you diversify, as you explained, until maybe at least the age of 12, or at least between 10 and 12, based on sex, and then try to do less hours per week than your age. So a 12-year-old do less than 12 hours a week of organized tennis. Try to do off-court conditioning at least 1 to 2 hours a week to be protective of injury. And then encourage free play. Encourage doing things for fun. Get the racket out of your hand and just let your kids know the risk of injury is not higher. It's actually higher to be on the court continuously with no other outside activity. So I'm not encouraging every tennis kid to go and climb trees and do something like that and risk falling out of a tree. But, you know, it's okay to, you know, play basketball with your friends and maybe get into soccer for one season a year. And so encourage other activities. I think at least to a certain, you know, point, at least until high school, so we can, you know, keep the kids healthy. So hopefully that gives you some specific, very specific recommendations. And again, a lot of these things are actually, if you go to our Emory Tennis Medicine site, if you go to just Google Emory and Tennis Medicine, we try to outline as many of these as we can. We keep, you know, adding things, and we'll evolve over time.
Great. Okay, so put your parent hat on now that you're a parent, and approach this from that viewpoint of, you know, your child is showing an interest in a specific sport, hopefully tennis, and how you're going to manage that.
Yeah, you know, I get asked this question a lot as far as, you know, a lot of parents, you know, including yourself, will, you know, say my child chose tennis, which is true, and a lot of them choose it, but it's also based on your environment, right? And so the environment is when you have a training academy that is inviting you to participate and you're doing pretty well, you're going to be more likely to choose it. But just like a parent, if you want to provide an environment for the optimal education for your child, even though your child may choose to only study in certain classes, you would probably say, hey, make sure you do your math homework too, and make sure you do your history homework, and that's also important. So I think that's how I approach it. So while I absolutely would love my kids to play tennis, and my goal for them is that they play enough so that I have someone to hit with, and if we build a tennis court that they can hit with me, I will also provide them opportunities to be involved in multiple environments and get them excited about it. And like I said, it doesn't mean that you have to be an organized competitive sport in every other sport, but actually grab a ball and just go, let's go shoot some hoops. And we do that and go to swim class with them and go to soccer. And so I think, you can help dictate the environment for your child. And while there are going to be a lot of opportunities to do other things, and your child can only make so many decisions based on it, I think you have to, you as a parent, I would say, have to take the responsibility for what you think might be the best. Just like you would with their education, you do that with their athletics. And so, yeah, I think that's how I'm going to approach it. And, you know, hopefully they always have a smile on their face. And right now he's very young, but I never ask him to pick up a tennis racket. He only walks up, and if he sees me with it, he'll go ask for his racket. And that's the only time we hit. And then once he's done, which is usually about 3 to 5 minutes, then we're off doing something else. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And keeping the smile on their face is crucial. And understanding that the smile won't always be on their face, and, you know, weathering those periods of time, that's a conversation for another show, but I love that advice. So thank you so much for doing the show today and for committing to come back on future dates and tackle different topics that have to do with our kids and their health on and off the court. And I'm just really looking forward to digging more into all of this with you as you get more data and, you know, that data is available to share. And I'm just really looking forward to it. So thank you.
Absolutely. I'll be speaking at the ITA conference in Naples and, you know, talking about what may keep a college healthy player healthy. And so maybe a good, good thing to go over for all the parents and coaches who are developing future college players. And there's a long-term path for that as well, too. So yeah, lots of great stuff. And, you know, thanks so much. I think having parents who are really passionate about keeping other kids healthy is so helpful for this. So thank all the parents and coaches, particularly, who are pushing, such as yourself, too. And anyone who wants to hit, you can just email me. And I'm always looking for good hitters. So even with your kids. So you just look me up, neerujainthi@gmail.com, and say, I'm ready to hit. So I'm there.
Awesome.
All right.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Thanks so much, Lisa.
Thank you so much. Thank
All right.
you. To my listeners, thank you so much for tuning in today. Just a reminder, we will not have a show next week, Thanksgiving week. I am going to enjoy having my family all home together, and I hope you're going to do the same. And just to let you know, the podcast will be up later today for today's show, and I will add a link to the Emory Tennis Medicine website that Dr. J kept referencing. That will be on our links page at parentingaces.com. So I do encourage you all to visit that website and bookmark it and visit it often, because he is constantly updating the information, and it's very consumer friendly. It's It's not medical jargon. It's easy to read, easy to understand. And just to share with you guys, I'm actually going to be attending an event tomorrow night with Dr. J. Mark Kovacs will be there as well. And it's all about developing a community that focuses around tennis and keeping our players healthy and productive on the court. So I'll be reporting back on that as well. Have a great week, everybody. Wishing you all a very happy Thanksgiving as well.